This is the December 2nd, 2013 interview of Mr. David Ingalls by Drew Radke for the Cooperstown Graduate Program's Research and Fieldwork course, recorded at 136 Seminary Road, Milford, New York. Mr. Ingalls, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today. I'd like to start from the beginning. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born in August 1st, 1949, and I was born at Bassett Hospital in Cooperstown, and I was born at a very early age.
Right from the beginning.
Day I was born, I was in a cornfield, and my mother was waiting in the truck while my dad finished picking the corn to take it to the restaurants in Cooperstown, the sweet corn. And when he finished, we went to the hospital, and I was born.
So she was waiting in the truck.
Yes, for my dad to finish picking the corn. At least that's the story my dad tells. And they were going to name me Bill because on the farm, that's when all the bills came. It was on the first of the month. Fortunately, they didn't.
So how did they settle on the name David?
No idea.
Not a family name?
My middle name is Edmund, and the first Edmund Ingalls came and settled Lynn, Massachusetts in 1628 and started a small shoe factory, made 300 pairs of shoes that first year.
Wow.
Edmund Ingalls.
So have you done a lot of research into your family background?
We have a book that has almost every Ingalls right down to the last two generations in America. So obviously somebody has every generation to spend the time to do some catch up. Hmm. We are working on Ancestry.com to do some updating, and it's a wonderful resource.
Hmm. So That's great. Now you mentioned your father working on the farm. Did you grow up on his farm?
Yes. Yep. I grew up on the family farm. It was a dairy farm at that time. It was an era in which dairy farming was prosperous, and it was a cow farm, predominantly a cow farm. My father was the fourth generation of Ingalls to be born on Christian Hill in the town of Hartwick, and his parents brought him down to Hartwick Seminary when he was three in 1922.
Wow.
And specifically driven by the soil. My grandfather's reason for coming down here was that he was tired of bruised ribs. When you plow hill land and you walk behind horses with a walking plow and you hit a rock, it throws the plow handles into your ribs and you get bruised ribs. So when he came down here, we had several hundred feet of topsoil that was 6 to 7 feet deep of topsoil, and there was no such things as rocks unless somebody brought them in. Hmm. So that was the coming about of Hartwick Seminary.
And how many acres was that?
1922, there was 120 acres initially. My grandfather bought it from the bank for $17,500, and it included the largest... I'm not sure it was Dutch or English barn. It was a gabled barn and included a five-bedroom oak hemlock house right across the street and 40 acres of select river bottom land, and then the rest was hill land and then forest land. So you always tried to break it up between forest for firewood and hill land for pasturing and valley land for plowing.
And what's the purpose of each of those, pasture land versus...
Well, if you are in the dairy business, there's a certain amount of land you need for growing corn mm-hmm. that you're going to silo over, or for hay that you're going to put in a mow. And during spring, summer, and fall, you want to let your cows go out and get their own forage by pasture land. And then you always needed a certain amount of forest land to cut your firewood for heating and for timbers for building. Mm-hmm. So it was a good mix.
How many cows did you have on your farm at any one time?
We had about 55 about 55 milk cows.
Okay.
Which is a good sized farm. It was a, you know, 2 to 3 man farm during the 50s and 60s.
And what were your jobs on the farm?
It was to stand at attention and do whatever assignment you were given. Actually, growing up, kids, you know, fed the calves. They would sweep in the silage in the manger, clean off behind the cows, push hay bales down, whatever needed to be done that would save my grandfather and father some steps. And obviously, as kids, we tried to stay out of their view so we wouldn't be recruited into work.
So I'm sure you, as kids, managed to find a lot of leisure time and leisure activities. What kind of things did you do when you weren't working?
Well, we had a hay mow, and I think we spent half our childhood climbing up the hay rope and hay trolley in the center of the barn. And swinging from mow to mow and playing hide-and-go-seek and tag in the barn. That was mostly in the off-season. The rest of the year, we had a lot of hills and creeks, and we spent a lot of our time camping, building tree forts, building lean-tos, and getting initiated by eating crayfish in the creeks and those kind of things, damming up the creeks. Creeks and forests were an unlimited source of childhood entertainment. As a matter of fact, during the 50s, early 60s in the morning, my mother would kick us out of the house and say she didn't want to see our dirty feet until dinner time. And my dad would always give us plenty to do on the farm.
That's very interesting. Do you have any stories about growing up on the farm or any particular experiences that you remember?
Well, I remember getting up early and working hard. There was a lot of farm ethics that went around with it. My dad was quite committed to kids growing up on the farm, and you weren't finished growing up until you left the farm, if you left it at all. Let's see. It was always good to have the three generations there because you got my grandfather's input, and he lived to be in his 80s, and he farmed it right up through that time. And then, you know, my dad's input as well. A lot of emphasis on work ethic, you know, work hard, love the Lord, and tell the truth was pretty much a lot of that. They were quite committed to being good farmers, and they were very smart about it. Work smart, not harder. You know, work smarter.
Right.
And they were quite thoughtful and planful. They had a good herd. They managed the machinery well. They managed the facilities well. They enjoyed doing it. And they also were farmers who made sure that, you know, you got days off and went vacationing. Hence, growing up, we went out to Cape Cod for a week, or later years down to Long Beach Island, New Jersey for a week. So there were farmers who worked and worked hard, but also knew that part of being good farmers was getting off the farm, and that wasn't the only thing they thought of, which was good. So,
good.
So childhood memories. Yeah, we did a lot of hiking too. All of the roads behind our farm from here to Mount Vision were always dirt roads, and we were pretty free. We did get in trouble once. I remember as an 8-year-old, me and another buddy, we hiked from here to Mount Vision, which was 50 miles round trip from 7 in the morning till about 7 or 8 at night. It cost me dearly in family discipline, but we did tell my mother that we were going to hike to Mount Vision, and hiking we did. It was a safe era in those days, and the dirt roads belonged to the farmers, and and it was a hike to remember.
You did 50 miles and...
30 miles.
30 miles,
yeah.
Okay, 30
and all back roads, all dirt roads.
Sure, sure.
And all the way over to Mount Vision and the other side of the hills.
Wow. Were there a lot of other children who lived in the area here?
There was a fair number. It was an era in which families were having 3 and 4 kids, and the farms were kind of back to back from here to Milford, from here to Cooperstown, old dairy farms back then. So there was a lot of farm kids, and so we had a lot of time to play with the neighborhood kids. And believe it or not, even though we were from Hartwick Seminary, not Cooperstown, we played a lot of baseball.
Really?
Yes. Well, when you have hay fields, you cut them. There's lots of open land, and it was always a fun thing to do. So,
Now, can you tell me more about your family? How many siblings did you have?
Had 3 siblings, an older brother, 2 years older, a sister, 2 years younger, and then a younger brother who was 5 years younger, who died at age 6. But so there's 3 of us that lived on the farm and grew up, you know, loved the farm. And when I say loved the farm, we loved the farm. The only objection I had as I got older was that you had to get up too early, you had to work too many hours, you got paid too little. But other than that, you know, I loved the farm.
So it was a labor of love.
Yes, to a degree. Yeah, farming was hard work. It was physically difficult work. Our farm, though, did split off. We were dairy farmers, but I think my father and grandfather were, you know, first of all, businessmen, and secondly, farmers. Okay. I mean, my grandfather, Harry Ingalls, you know, he had the first milking machine in the township. He had the first tractor. And he always, and same with, you know, one of the first cars, he always was avant-garde. And he had enough resources that he could afford to, you know, take the risk to try new things. And so that was kind of the framework that we grew up. They were always thinking on how best to get the job done and make money doing it.
Do you have any specific memories about a time when your father or grandfather were particularly, what's the word I'm looking for? Maybe smart about a specific way they were farming, or?
Well, my grandfather, he started Creamery right in our dairy, as did many, many farmers. And it was just before I came along that he used to take the horses and go up to Goey Pond, which was, you know, the better part of 2 miles from here, and cut ice all winter. And then they would process and bottle milk and deliver it door to door in the neighborhood. Yeah. And then as my dad's generation came along, they started the Cooperstown Dairy in Cooperstown.
Okay.
They had 5 or 6 Guernsey farms that brought their milk into the dairy, and 1 Holstein farm. And they processed and bottled milk and cream and sold it door-to-door all through Cooperstown for a generation.
Those are types of cows?
Yeah.
For the uninitiated?
Yes. Guernsey is a brown and white cow. It's a middle-sized cow that produced higher butter fat, was a lot more flavorful. Most days, nowadays, unless people buy, you know, organic milk or buy them from a local farm, which the government is trying to eliminate, it was they wouldn't know what good flavored milk tastes like. Now it's all been homogenized and pasteurized, and it's, you know, chalk water. So back then, milk had a lot of different flavors, and they were middle-sized cows. So and a favored cow.
So they would go and sell milk in Cooperstown.
Yep. They had a processing plant there, and during the 50s, I think they had 6 different trucks that went and delivered milk all over Cooperstown in the summer, up and down the lake, door to door. So,
wow.
Yep, a good name. My grandfather made money doing it, as did my dad. So,
how long was that?
It went on until into the 60s, at which time the government had decided that these small, homegrown, small town dairies weren't what the government wanted, and they put all of those small dairies out of business by saying, you know, each month, how much profit did you make? Send it in. And back then it was $700 or $800 a month, and it was a milk marketing redistribution. And it was a real breach by government. Somebody deciding that homegrown milk wasn't as profitable for the society at large, instead of letting the society decide its profitability, and so it put all the small dairies out of business. So
how did that affect your family?
Well, you know, my parents were always law-abiding, tax-paying people, but they also felt that if you were smart, you would minimize your tax liability in every honest way that you could, through investments or otherwise. You know, my dad never said, you know, watch your back with the government, but that was a real hurtful thing in my grandparents and my dad's generation. When you build a wonderful dairy and you have a wonderful response from the community, and the government comes along and intentionally decides to put small businesses out of business. Did you want to get political in this conversation? Or just economic?
It's,
yeah, my dad always pays his taxes.
Interesting.
And up front. So, yeah, but, you know, the resourcefulness. At that point, my dad, you know, he had gone to Cornell, and he did animal husbandry as well as agriculture.
Okay.
So my dad was, since we had a wonderful location and wonderful soil, he had started growing sweet corn, and we started a farm stand, and he grew gladiolus. It was a half an acre of gladiolus flowers and all sorts of other small vegetables. And so that initiative really took root in the later 60s when my sister and I kind of took it over for 4 years as we put ourselves through college. And got to the point where we were milking cows at 5 in the morning and picking corn at 6:30 and, you know, picking 40, 50, 60 bushel of sweet corn every morning. And my dad, being a real good farmer, produced some of the nicest corn in the area. And so we took, you know, the good land, the good location, and expertise, and ended up making more on sweet corn, vegetables, and flowers at a farm stand than we did with cows, because the price on the profitability on cows was gradually going down in the later mid 60s into the 70s, the time when most all small dairies went out of business. So at that point, we had developed the vegetable business, and then branched into what eventually became 25 acres of U-Pick strawberries and 8 acres of U-Pick blueberries, and we had 10 acres of U-Pick raspberries.
Wow.
And they became instant gold mines in the area. Every community needs those from their farmers, and so we did it well and did it right, and good for the community and good for the farmer.
So how did your family decide on those particular...
Well, let's see. When my brother came back from Vietnam, he had spent some time in Washington and outside of Seattle, up in those areas where there was a lot of fruit and vegetables being grown. He came back with a strawberry idea. When I came back to the farm after, 5 years in New York going to school in liberal arts... he sent me to Cornell, and he said, talk to the head of pomology and small fruits and get a recommendation. So I came back with blueberries and raspberries. So we, honed out a piece of the land and gave it a shot.
And what year was that?
Oh, dear. That would have been early 70s for me, late 60s for my brother. I think my brother first, when he came back... they did field corn unprofitably, and then moved into the strawberries. So, that was a great era and a lot of fun era. We had hundreds of people weekly that came in to do picking of berries. You know, it was an instant. So,
were they all people from the local area, or
I would say within a 40-mile radius?
Wow,
there's enough people and. Believe it or not, there was still a generation that didn't mind standing on their heads to pick strawberries. We were concerned that when we did U-Picks, that the generation that would used to grow gardens and pick berries was passing. And we weren't sure the younger generation was going to have that kind of vim and vigor to get out and in the heat of the day and in bugs and weeds and pick berries, but we were wrong because that generation had now become the generation of the office, and they were quite mm-hmm. anxious to get out in the garden. Mm. So not their own, but in somebody else's.
Interesting.
Yes. So, and those we still have the blueberry field today. My dad and I planted those in 1973, and we have a wonderful field of you pick blueberries and a wonderful clientele of folks who like to come out and pick blueberries in July and August.
That's great.
Yeah.
So is your brother still involved in the...
He was up until about 5 years ago, at which time he had the river bottom land. And I had the hill land, and he sold his out to Dreams Park.
Okay.
What had happened about 12 years ago, my father divided the farm in half and gave my brother, he had both sides of the road assessed, which both sides of the road came to about $42,000. And so I got 100 acres of the hill land, which wonderful for blueberries.
Right.
My brother had about 100 acres of the river bottom land, which were great for strawberries. And he sold his out to the Dreams Park at $20,000 an acre.
Wow.
Because it was more profitable than working hard growing strawberries.
Sure.
And he bought a little hillland piece and, you know, grew an acre or so. And he has a little farm stand down there now. But that was kind of more of an economic decision than it was a, you know, a commitment to agricultural decision.
Hmm.
So...
And so you still live very close to the
yes.
Dreams Park land.
Well, that's across the street. I'm mm-hmm. on the still on the 100 acres on the west side of Route 28.
Okay.
And the Dreams Park is on the other side of the road.
Hmm.
Now, I wish it were still on farm down there, but I understand that the county, when agriculture went out, farmers had to make other decisions.
Sure. Did you agree with your brother's decision at the time?
I'd agree that I would have been real happy if he wanted to split the $2 million with me.
Hmm.
But it's I would prefer it was agriculture land, but
sure.
I actually didn't have a vote in the decision. It wasn't my land. Hmm. So
right.
And in families, you don't always tell them what you think.
Hmm.
Unless you get permission. Because then it looks like envy, you know. But
sure.
My side of the land is not for sale. I love the forest and love growing things, and so it will stay, you know, in the farming tradition. And all four of my sons each have a little piece in agriculture, whether you're in Seattle or in World Wildlife Fund in Laos. So
how many acres do you have here?
About 100 acres or so.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
And you use it not only for the blueberries, but also...
I rent some of it out for corn,
mm-hmm.
For corn land to keep it tilled. And the rest is pretty much forest timberland.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my sons and I, we've done a lot of logging over the years, both on our land and other people's lands. So, and we really love, you know, creation.
Mm-hmm.
So... And I think it's paid off a lot because, you know, my wife and I had four boys, and we worked our boys well in growing things. My kids grew up all through elementary school summers picking raspberries, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some days we it's all you pick, but we would pick sometimes a couple hundred pints a day and sell them at the farm stand.
Wow.
And kids, 7 and 8 and 9 year old, since child labor laws didn't apply, and since my kids like to take initiative,
mm-hmm.
You know, they would sell them at the farm stand and always make enough money to for summer camp and fall clothes and anything else. So,
great. I'd like to go back a little way, as you mentioned, going off to college
mm-hmm.
in New York. Can you talk a little bit about where you went? And
yes, well, let's see. It was... at the later 60s, mm-hmm. it was a difficult time in America's history.
Sure.
Vietnam. And I went to school just north of New York City and majored in liberal arts for those years. My brother spent 2 years in Vietnam. And that was also the time of transitioning for farming, too, for my dad, mm-hmm. you know, going more from cows My brother and I joke about the fact that when we both left the farm that year, my brother, he went to Vietnam, I went to New York, and my father got a barn cleaner and a silent loader that first year. Now, a silent loader, for readers who don't know, is you pull a rope at the bottom of the silo, and the silent loader goes around and shoots all the silage down into a cart. You don't have to get up there and shovel it all winter like we did growing through the 60s. And the same with the barn cleaner. It's a truck that goes around the gutters behind the cows and takes all the manure out and dumps it in a 2-ton manure spreader, and you just sit there and sigh and break out of sweat watching it. So those replaced two men. So that was, we felt we'd been replaced by the silent loader and the barn cleaner that year. So, and my dad, it's interesting to note, my dad, going back to that era in perspective, you know, he grew up on the farm. He was the only son. My grandfather had two farms and five houses, and was a good businessman, and they were quite prosperous. My dad got a full scholarship for 4 years at Cornell, came back to the farm for 2 years, and then enlisted in the Navy, and he was in the Navy Air Corps. And that was in 42, during the Second World War. He could have been exempt in that if he was the exclusive farm son, you know, the only son, and the eldest, he could have been exempt from enlistment in the military at that time. Mm-hmm. And yet he chose to go, broke his parents' heart, because he went voluntarily. Mm-hmm. I think his father said later that you did the right thing. I don't know if his mother ever forgave him, but he did come home. So he flew in the Navy, in the Navy Air Corps, and both the Atlantic and the Pacific. His job was to find German U-2 boats that time, you know, and so it was reconnaissance. So going back, all right, so in the later 60s, so my brother went to Vietnam, I went to school, and in the summers I came back and paid all my tuition through raising and selling sweet corn and vegetables.
Wow.
For 4 years, which was, you know, a wonderful way to pay your way through college. So sure. When I got done with 4 years, I didn't know a thing, nor did my sister. So that was good. You know, I stayed on the farm. I got married, and I stayed on the farm partially. But at that time, you know, we could make enough for a living for summer, spring, and fall, but not year-round. So I went back to graduate school and education, and then went in education, did the farm on the side for the next 35 years.
Wow.
So I can remember coming back, going back a paragraph, coming back my first year back from college, and it was hay season, and they were long, hard days. And my dad and I were about to unload a load of hay in the hay mow. And, you know, there's 2 ton of hay bales, and my dad pushed them up the elevator, and it's about 98 degrees in the hay mow, and all that hay dust, and you got to stack 2 ton in about 20 minutes. And I can remember saying to my dad before I went up, I said, "Dad, you know, I'm a college boy now, so isn't this a job for the hired man?" And my dad was, he had a tough side to him, but he said, "Well, the hired man was here for the 5 o'clock milking this morning. Where were you?" And then he said to me, he said, "David, I want you to hear me real clearly, but if you are too educated to stack hay bales," he said, "you're too educated for your own good." So he said, "Up in the mow." And then he said, "Get rid of that bandana, because," he said, "there won't be any hawks living on this farm while your brother's in Vietnam." And that was a day and age in which, you know, the objectors to the war, and we probably all should have been, would wear these bandanas around your forehead. Well, mine was a drip strip, you know, for when you're working in the mow. But my dad took the metaphor as being from that perspective, and having gone down to New York to go to school. So that was my dad's, you know, political position, you know, coming from a military background. Mm-hmm. And at that time, thinking that, you know, we were doing Southeast Asia a favor and the nation a favor by helping the country of Vietnam become an independent, you know, self-determining country. And so my dad was, you didn't have to ask him where he stood on issues like that. Mm. So, but I always had a good relationship with my dad.
Did he express an opinion when your brother joined the military?
Nope, he was drafted. Back in that day and age, the